Let's begin, especially because we're going to use the aspiration of Samantabhadra to help summarize the last several months of our work together. So I'm curious, though, what your initial sort of gut-level impressions of this liturgy are. Does it seem like too out there?
The first one was pretty depressing.
The first one, we're not working on the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going down, it's like,
I know.
Okay.
It seemed really familiar, didn't
check,
it?
Check, I mean, check, check. Yeah.
It's so accurate.
It's so accurate, yeah.
The thing is that if you read these other, we have other lots of them, and they don't anywhere near zero in on the kind of current situation we're in. And Emily, I thought, we've done this other one before a few times, and I thought Emily felt, and I agree, it just makes a lot more sense to really try to relate. I mean, it's not hard to relate to why we're doing this and what we're asking for. We're asking for some kind of real change and guidance and asking the energy to come through us and each other so that, you know, things can really move out of this pit that we're in collectively. So, better to see
Joseph?
The truth.
So the aspiration is Samantabhadra. Was there something in there that sort of stuck?
The five families.
Yay! Right answer.
Right answer. The five families. Would you and which are?
Karma.
Very good.
And we got all their wisdoms.
We have all their wisdoms and all their neuroses.
And their realms, which we haven't really gone over too much.
Realms, we have the whole thing is very complete. So it was I'm sure it was very gratifying to see something familiar in there.
And also gratifying to hear something that I knew what it was about.
Yay!
It feels like it's an opening. It's an opening and a reaching. Well, it's aspiration, right?
Uh-huh.
So it really is a prostration of sorts, mm-hmm. along with all five Buddha families.
Especially since all sentient beings manifest the five Buddha families through their styles of being neurotic, which we also share.
So what's Rigpa? Realize the nature of Rigpa.
Rigpa is awareness, insight of a non-dual nature, and I'll talk about that a little bit coming up. Yeah, it's very interesting because the translation I've been using is different. And there's a few major differences, but mostly it's the words used, and sometimes they will leave things in Tibetan, sometimes they'll leave things in Sanskrit, sometimes they'll translate things into English words. So sometimes it's difficult figuring out what they're talking about. So, anyone else?
I love
what did
we
you
do
love?
It outside.
That we do it outside.
And we do it to liberate all these beings
yes.
that listen to us.
Yes.
And yes. that are out
and
there.
The people around
and
us.
The people
we're
that we're actually the Buddha, and we're proclaiming the wisdom of the Dharma.
Within
and
the
all these
earshot
beings,
of all sentient beings.
Anything that's around.
We should go do it around. Actually, it was interesting. I went to the protest down at the State House yesterday. We actually went into the State House and were...
Do it there.
We're like, you know, doing protest chants
yes.
outside the House chamber.
Wow.
Isn't it lovely?
So, but that's those are the yes. people who need this.
Yes, that's right.
We've been doing this for some time, some of us, ever since I asked the author if we could copy and use it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you mean the Gesar chant, not Gesar. This one.
Yeah, oh yeah, okay. We've been doing this one too. And it has a remarkable effect.
Mm.
The idea is that it isn't only like people who you happen to know or animals that might be within earshot. But actually there are these other realms that we talk about in Dharma that are invisible to us but are actually very present. And so we also, it doesn't like we have to have a clear picture of who we're speaking to as much as the willingness to just open up and share the wisdom and power of these teachings that are embedded in this recitation.
So, several months ago, in colder weather, we began talking about our emotional life and how we work with it through practice and study and experience and screwing up and making mistakes and apologizing and all that. And so, what I'd like to do is sort of begin from the beginning a little bit to set some context, and then we'll see the flip that occurs with the aspiration Samantabhadra. So, I like to make the distinction between that which is close and that which is most vivid. We first have to talk about that which is most vivid. Then we'll talk about later that which is most close. Okay? That which is most vivid is our emotional life. Emotions give us information. They are physical. They are in our face. They direct our behavior. They are a cause for us to have to suppress ourselves sometimes. Sometimes we act out and we feel terrible afterwards. Sometimes we don't and wish we did. We can get very confused. And, you know, Trungpa Rinpoche talked about emotions being a problem because we're always trying to strategize what to do about them. That either we fall into the pitfall of... Is it right?
What did it look like?
Hang on. Please stand by.
That's okay.
Okay. We can fall into the pitfall of identifying with our emotional life so much that we distort reality. And we develop character styles based on some distortion of our emotional life. Or we can become neurotic and try to pick and choose what we'll let manifest, what we'll let out, what we'll let out. In the meantime, we tend to feel terrible about ourselves. So, many people, myself included, came to meditation and to Buddhism because it was just too much. It was too painful. And so, you know, I met with a meditation instructor and I learned how to, like, follow my breath. I'm not sure it helped for a very long time. It probably made things worse. Probably so I thought. What meditation does is introduces, in terms of the emotions, introduces us to shamatha and vipassana. Remember what shamatha means?
Calm abiding.
Calm abiding. We sort of sit still. Our minds aren't particularly sitting still, but we are at least appearing to sit still to impress our friends who look at us and say, well, boy, you look really serene. Well, we know better. But what happens with shamatha is a process of taming our mind. It's a process of seeing thoughts come and go, developing a little bit of detachment, even though what we have to do is experience them most vividly, not escape from them. It's like we're there. And so we begin to appreciate that we have a place in our mind that is basically calm and objective and doesn't get all caught up. And that's shamatha. And, you know, so it's often the case that after a sitting period, we feel, you know, our senses are a little sharper. We see things better. We may speak in a more modulated tone than when we were driving here and yelling at fellow motorists. But then there's Vipassana, which is how do we use a mind that is a little calmer? And Vipassana is... somebody else?
Clear sight.
Insight, clear insight. We begin to look at things objectively. We begin to notice that, do I have anger? Do I have angry thoughts? Do look at how I make this emotion into a history of resentment that I continually nurture and sort of feed and like blaze. Look how I establish an identity for myself through these emotional gyrations and how it's always painful. It doesn't, you know, if it doesn't feel right, but we find that we do it compulsively. All right, that's Vipassana. But what we get out of that is a greater sense of generosity to ourselves and trust in ourselves, that we do not have to be overwhelmed by our own minds. That everything that occurs is workable. And so we learn to develop our, to work with our emotional life through a process of taming, but also that of seeing things clearly. Okay? Any questions? Anything to add to that? Trying to make this really straightforward.
I actually thought about that, that the way we deal with our emotions is often like throwing stuff on that fire, like we throw a juniper berry, we stir it up, and then we're like,
I like the smell. This smells like me.
Yeah, well, they really piss me off, and then you feed it, that you feed those stories.
It's amazing. We just do this all the time.
So just with the fire, so in one of the examples you were just saying, are you trying to, say, distinguish in your mind like there really is a fire or you're thinking there's a fire?
Well, it's a metaphor. But it's the process that we have of taking some kind of vivid emotional response and just feeding it and making it worse and developing a whole storyline, and you know, it becomes a five-act tragedy, then it becomes an epic.
I mean, you could light a match and watch it go out, and that could be your emotion. Or you could light the match and then you could throw in like, oh, yesterday, the day before.
Yes.
Feed the fire.
Light the box.
What?
Light the box.
Light the whole box. Instead of just the
match. Throw it on the floor.
But there's a problem, because when you light the match, there's a real tendency to put it on something, or else you're going to burn your finger. And we feel the heat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's really hard to stay with what we're doing and feel the heat. And not, you know, throw it into the straw.
Well, or the other thing you can do is just go...
when
you
that,
pull it out.
Yes.
That's what I like to do.
That's called nirvana.
No.
Cessation.
Yes, exactly.
Cessation.
Well, but I'm saying, like, it starts to come to you and you just blow it out so you don't know about it.
Well, I think blowing it out, though, has other metaphors, because you could try to suppress it.
Right, that could
blowing
be.
It out, just not wanting to hassle it. Whereas cessation is really when the flame simply just extinguishes
by itself.
Because there's nothing to support it.
It doesn't have
But fortunately, it hasn't reached your fingertips yet.
That would be the lucky
So this is where the metaphor kind of breaks down.
Yeah, right.
Well, it could be the candle that burns down, you know.
It's just a candle.
Yeah.
It's just a puddle of wax.
Runs out of stuff to burn.
Yeah, I was noticing how often the phrase... allowing the thought to rest in itself.
We're getting there. We are getting there.
Beautiful.
That's good.
That's going to be the key instruction.
Yeah, you know how often.
Yes. But first, in order to let the things rest in themselves, we have to develop confidence around them, and we have to understand them in a really gut level way. And we do that to begin with through cultivating shamatha and vipassana, through cultivating calm abiding and clear insight. That leads us into Mahayana. And I realize that, oh, by the way, a reference for the Hinayana approach is light comes through by Dzigar Khantrol Rinpoche, which is a lovely book on how to use your mind to work with your habitual patterns.
Wow.
It's lovely. It is a perfect exposition of how of our basic intelligence being able to see clearly and to help tame ourselves. So, and for many people, by the way, they'll come to practice meditation and they'll do, and it'll work. They'll feel calmer, they'll feel, you know, a little bit more intelligent, they'll feel gentler. And that's fine. And they might move on because they've kind of gotten that set. But then there are the hardcore. And that's where Mahayana comes in. Mahayana is not satisfied that you're less screwed up than you used to be. Because we all know that we can get more screwed up than we are now anyway. But Mahayana is our clear seeing has noticed other people. And we've noticed that they're kind of messed up too. And I thought it was just me. I actually, when I was a kid, I thought I was the only person who was screwed up and everyone else was just fine.
Wait until you were how old?
38?
What's that? No siblings?
Oh, I have siblings, but they seem to have their act together better than I do.
That was how you saw it.
That, at least that's exactly.
I mean, it's every just on subjective point of view, right? There is a point where, you know, you begin to see, like, you're not the only one who's screwed up, and that's a major revelation. And
it is.
You don't have to blame yourself for their neuroses.
Yes.
They have, which is a huge relief.
And you can even, and eventually even feel some kind of kinship with others when you see themselves doing things that you know that you do yourself. And it's really hard to judge them. And at a certain point, you want to actually be helpful. That's where Mahayana comes in. Mahayana, we are upping the ante. And sometimes people think, well, Hinayana, that's really austere, and you have to, like, tame yourself. And Mahayana is heroic and gentle and sweet, and you love everybody. Well, that's bullshit. The fact is that Mahayana is much tougher because you hold yourself to a higher standard. You become a warrior, and you're willing to work with yourself much more aggressively than in Hinayana. Hinayana teaches us to be gentle, and Mahayana teaches us to be less gentle. And we all know that habitually we give ourselves a hard time for very normal human being things. And we forgive ourselves for things that we should really call ourselves to account for. And Mahayana is much, in some ways, much more rigorous. But you're still working directly with the emotions, but in terms of antidotes. So, and this is in Hinayana also, but it's much more emphasized. What's an antidote? If you are lustful and passionate, you think of the ugliness of our physical bodies. You think of all the fluids that come out of us, etc. Okay?
Pus and bile.
Pus and, yeah, all that stuff, you know. you know, we tend to idealize the bodies of people who we lust for and forget that they worked exactly the same ways as ours do. If we're angry or aggressive, we meditate on love and compassion. And if we're like being stupid, we look at cause and effect. And in Shanti Deva, there's this one, I love the fourth chapter. It's like, this is a, sort of a dramatic thing, because you take the bodhisattva vows, you want to save everybody, you feel great, there's a chorus of angels, it's just wonderful. And then, chapter four, what did I just do? And you have to say, okay, if I want to heroically serve all beings and cause them not to suffer, then I'm not ready. I can't do that. I'm too screwed up myself. I have to work triply hard. And I have to, and there's this wonderful passage at the end of chapter four where you sort of take on your obstructions. And you think of them as obstructions, and you compare them with normal enemies who, and at the end you say, well, normal enemies, if I defeat them, they go away, but they can come back. But if I use the sword of wisdom, if I actually see through all this stuff clearly, I can get rid of them forever. So let's work on the sword of wisdom. Let's understand that all this has qualities of emptiness, of insubstantiality, even though appearance is very vivid. That's Mahayana. But at the same time, one reason you're able to do that is that you discover, or someone tells you, more likely someone tells you and you believe it, that you have Buddha nature. That even though we cover it up, there's essential who we are-ness that is fundamentally awake. Otherwise, we wouldn't put ourselves through this stuff. So that's Mahayana. So it's very path-oriented. Hinayana, Mahayana are called Sutrayana. And sometimes it's called the causal vehicle. We are building the causes of waking up, of becoming enlightened. And as we do that, as we confront ourselves, as we tame ourselves, as we use insight, we do get wiser and gentler and more intelligent and more skillful in our world. It happens. Look at these three. I knew them when. Never mind. Actually, I only knew Emily when.
That's true. A long time ago.
That brings us to Vajrayana. And what we're going to do is we're flipping things around a little bit. We're starting not with our suffering, not with our pain, not with what seems to be the most vivid, but we're starting with that which is closer to us than that. And sometimes that's called the universal ground. And if you look in your copies, and by the way, this is lovely because you have your translation and I have a different one.
Okay.
And mine is from Khunlok Rinpoche, Penetrating Wisdom. It's a commentary on these pages. And he goes into a lot of detail. I guarantee that when you read it, there will be stuff that will just fly away. There will be some stuff that you can sort of really grab onto. But I think we have, actually, let's talk about learning about this material. It's not like Sutrayana, the causal vehicle. Things are clear. You actually understand things or you don't. This is different. For me, and I'll ask my compatriots here, I can read something like this and it can grab me and I can feel like I'm with it. And then it becomes sort of gossamer. And then it begins to go away. You know, like when you wake up after a dream, the dream seems so vivid when you wake up, and then 5 minutes later, huh? And so when I read this kind of material, it has that quality of connecting. And I, these folks know, I work at this. I use my intellect as much as I can, but at the same time, experientially, you sort of get a glimpse. The glimpse goes away. It comes back. And then it comes back to, then it comes to you. And that's the fun part. You could be practicing meditation. You could be in a parking lot somewhere. You could be across the street. And all of a sudden, the whole thing begins to sort of come together. And then it goes away.
I was trying, when you said it comes, that's so sort of as you're doing something else, you suddenly realize,
yeah,
oh, that's what that was saying?
Something like that. Or there's a sense of what they're, not what they're saying, but what they mean.
Right.
Because you've experienced.
Yes. But you sort of have to, you sort of have to work at it. Is experience, understanding is fine. But only, but you see how shallow understanding is. Experience is much more, is much more rare, but it comes. Then there's realization. I mean, that's.
But is it sort of the difference between like trying to really think hard about it when you read something and just trying to feel it?
Yes, that would be the difference between understanding and experience. And we all know what experiences do. They come and they go. But they build over time.
That's true, although I think the other side of this, which is why this text is so important, is because it actually gives you instruction on how to work with your these kinds of experiences. When you see them, when you actually come into your awareness, field awareness,
you recognize them.
Yes. And so you begin to realize that this is actually how the mind is tamed on this much more profound level than just trying to do something with an antidote, like, you know, give it some kind of medicine. I mean, medicine's treating a symptom, but it's not really dealing with the cause, right? The cause is really the issue. So we're getting more into the causal dimension.
And we're starting with the fruition. We're starting with the entire view. So the first couple paragraphs is the whole thing. And then we're gonna descend into stuff that's more familiar to us experientially. So it starts with ho.
You want my text?
Nope. That's going to be fine. I'm going to read mine and you can kind of see what the differences are.
Okay.
I'm not going to read very much of it, though. Ho. What is ho? Punor Pripyatchi calls it non-dual joy. It's not quite yo, but it's but it sort of clears the air. And it says, it's sort of like, listen up. And a lot of texts in different traditions start with, like, listen up. Beowulf starts with, quat.
Some start with, hum.
What's that?
Some start with, hum.
Yeah. Hum. And there's all kinds of little exclamations that would direct your attention. Listen up. Emaho.
Emaho.
Home or ke.
Or in the Mahayana, evam, which is Sanskrit for thus have I heard. In the Heart Sutra. Now listen up, the Buddha's saying something. I've heard this from the Buddha. You better like pay attention. I'm not just doing party talk here. So it talks about samsara and nirvana. Two paths, one ground. Okay, this is called the universal ground. And I've been thinking about the ground a lot lately. And it's hard to think about.
I don't mean
it. Yes. Please illuminate.
So
But it says two paths and two fruitions.
Uh-huh.
I see samsara and nirvana as the two fruitions.
But the two paths, there's a path of ignorance, there's a path of wisdom.
Uh-huh.
He's going to go into both.
Yeah.
But it's one ground. There, and this is important. This is listen to me. Okay? We have the tendency to divide reality. We divide reality into good and bad. We divide reality into sane and insane. We divide reality from a Buddhist point of view into nirvana, which is completely enlightened, and samsara, which is our screwed up habitual pattern. The ground is above both. It's the samsara and nirvana. I want to say the source. It's not cause. It's not like God creating anything. Okay? But everything that exists manifests the universal ground. Samsara, nirvana, when it's screwed up, what is not screwed up. Now, the confusion we have as Westerners is we tend to try to figure out where the ground is. Okay? Is it in the mind or is it in the world? Okay?
That's dual.
What's that?
That's dualistic.
Exacto. Therefore, the ground subsumes both. It is neither the mind nor appearance. So you asked about Rigpa. You asked about Rigpa. Rigpa is a manifestation of the ground sort of from a mind point of view. And Dharmadhatu is a manifestation of the ground or of expression of the ground sort of from an appearance point of view. Kind of. But the whole thing is very fluid. And the whole thing is sort of get it, and then that, now you see how it goes into Gossamer, and then you don't understand it anymore?
Yeah.
That's the universal ground.
It's not solid, so therefore there's nothing to solidify, to grasp onto as an answer. But there is, it's a space.
It's a space, but it includes everything.
Right. It's like a giant container without an edge.
Okay? But now, here's what's important. This is also this is closer to us than anything else. When we have no thoughts between thoughts, when sometimes we see how in meditation especially our mind can go here, our mind can go there, our mind can go there, our mind can go there. Well, where's the pivot? It's one way of approaching the universal ground. It's that kind of pivot thing that our mind does.
So that when it's actually not stuck on
this
thought or that thought or the other thought.
Has it ever happened to you that you're sort of sitting and the thoughts are simply energy and you're not sort of clutching them? They're just sort of like, and sometimes when thoughts are subtle, and we're not really involved with them, we can see that. But it's really interesting when our thoughts are strong and we actually see that they're just manifestations of something else. But this is a glimpse. And so, Samantabhadra, there's an iconography. Samantabhadra is naked. So is his girlfriend. He's white. His girlfriend is blue. He may represent appearance. He may represent the phenomenal world. She is space. It's one way of looking at it.
Or he's blue and she's white. Because you'll see
in
a lot of the tankas.
Yep.
So it doesn't matter. it's not a, the color is not
but there's a contrast there.
So in my second page, what it says for me, okay, and this is where the five wisdoms start, and this is going to be okay,
just beside it.
I'll start with I Samajabhadra, know naturally that ground without cause and condition. See, it's going to sound a little different.
That's page our first one, page. The third
it's our first page, the third paragraph.
I am without the defects of superposition and denial of outer and inner. I am unobscured by the darkness of mindlessness. And here's the next few lines is what I want to pay attention to. Therefore, self-appearance is unobscured. Okay, what sentence do you have for that?
Therefore, apparent phenomena are free from any imperfection.
Oh, so it doesn't use self-appearance. Interesting. If self-awareness remains in place, what line do you have?
By remaining in sharp intrinsic awareness.
Very good. There is no fear even if the threefold world is destroyed. Okay, so there's an appearance side, there's an awareness side.
We don't have panic either.
Yeah, it says, even if the three realms are destroyed, there is neither fear nor panic.
Right. Yeah, you'll often, these texts will often talk about self-awareness. And I think the Tibetan is pretty untranslatable, because we think of self-consciousness as like of a self here. This is more like awareness being aware of itself. So this is self as reflexive. You can't be aware of awareness, but you can be. But awareness can be aware of itself. That's sort of how they look at it.
But also, awareness is neutral. It doesn't have any bias. It's not making any judgment.
Yep.
That's why it's harder to deal with from our point of view of thinking we're supposed to do something about it.
And awareness that we all have, the universal ground of us, can neither be augmented nor diminished. It is no different from us, a Buddha, Hannibal Lecter, our Presidente, same universal ground.
It's like energy can be created or destroyed.
Yes, it can, but it cannot be increased nor decreased.
Yeah.
So the difference between someone who is a Buddha and someone who is not a Buddha is simply recognition of that awareness. Patro Rinpoche say, if you see it in the morning, you're enlightened in the morning. If you see it at lunchtime, you're enlightened after lunch. If you recognize that awareness. But the thing is, there's no you to recognize it. It recognizes itself. Okay.
Does that make sense?
No.
It's going to make sense, and then it's going to fade away. And then you're going to be reading something, or are you going to be swimming in Walden Pond or something like that, and you'll go, "Oh yeah, okay," and that'll go away.
Sink to the bottom of the pond.
I'm sorry?
It'll sink to the bottom of the pond.
Well, it doesn't go anywhere. It's just about what we do as a path is that we're actually learning how to recognize it in our experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step, and it just little brief flashes, and then as time goes on, as we train, it extends, and we can we don't have to just view it as a flash in the pan.
So from the universal ground, we're moving into manifestation, but these are like not cause, but they're sort of expressions of, and those are the five wisdoms. And the five wisdoms are a way for us to apprehend reality in an enlightened manner. So what we think is anger or aggression is the wisdom of clarity.
Can you say that sentence again?
I never remember what I just said.
The enlightened wisdom are...
What's your question, Roberta?
Don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, here's what
I said something I wanted to understand.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. In which case, let me backtrack a little bit. Okay. The five wisdoms are expressions, enlightened expressions of this universal ground. So that we, us individuals, can act with sanity. So we can approach enlightenment using who we are, so that anger and aggression is not conventional anger and aggression. It's mirror-like wisdom, so wisdom of clarity in a disguise. It's like we manifest our Buddha nature by being fucked up. And this is that.
It's like alchemy, though, in some ways, maybe.
Like in what way?
Well, something, you know, if it's just plain old steel, it can kind of turn to gold.
People use the word transmute all the time to talk about what happens with what we think are our kleshas, what we think are our problems, that our passion, our lust, the things that make us do things that are stupid. Though that's simply a disguised form of the wisdom that sees the differences between things. Our pride, I listened to the talk, I didn't hear the word pride talked about too much last week. Our pride, you know, we sort of get puffed up and we revel in all the things that we do and how attractive we are and all that stuff. Our pride is basically an ego version of the wisdom of equality.
Or equanimity.
Or equanimity, which sees things in their glory without judging one being better than the other.
But let's just go back for a second, because you brought up the question of alchemy and transmutation. That's what we're studying right now is not
that.
Transmutation. We're not studying transmutation. That's a Vajrayana practice, which this is kind of like sitting on top. We're teaching. This is an ultimate teaching, and that's still working with more relative kind of dimensions when you're actually transforming neurosis into wisdom. We use deity practice for that in Vajrayana.
See, the four of us have been oppressed by a 14th century writer named Lungchenpa for the past year or so. And he writes all the time that this stuff here is not about applying antidotes. It's not about trying to remedy our stuff, but simply seeing it what it is. That our competitiveness is all accomplishing wisdom. So we don't have to do anything about our competitiveness. We've already done that.
Seeing
it. This is why we have to start from the top. We start from the universal ground. And then we begin to see how our nature is fundamentally enlightened.
So it's almost like, sounds like you've got this, like, yeah. I'm just using it as an example.
Please.
You've got like this, you know, like, sort of like this umbrella.
Five
things.
Umbrella is a term that we use all the time.
I'm just saying it like an umbrella. And then just metaphorically, like, you're down here.
Yeah.
And like things are happening, and then they go and you're trying to get them into these different five buckets.
That's pretty good. Five spokes.
You're coming up into these five buckets, you know, and it's like you've got this umbrella that's sort of like the universal ground.
Yes.
It's like a frame.
Yeah, like it's
Except, yes, But...
And you're not doing anything. It's just you're going up.
Yes. This is where the stuff gets really subtle. The literature is rich in metaphor, and no metaphor quite works.
Right.
The problem is that we think that the spokes are different from the umbrella itself. The spokes and the umbrella itself, the material that actually shields us from the rain, are actually the same thing. And people much wiser than us get into disputes about this stuff.
Well, the most important thing, I'm
including Michael,
we come from both angles. We are definitely working on ourselves as individuals, and that's mm-hmm. where we have in the Vajrayana we have skillful means to develop, which are much more rapid in terms of being able to transform or transmute these toxins. At the same time, without the view, which is what we're presenting now, we're just house cleaning. We're like just waiting for the dust to come in tomorrow. We're going to have to start all over again. You know, whereas you have to employ this kind of like higher ultimate view mm-hmm. in order to be able to understand what's informing the actual more, the
but
dynamic.
We are the umbrella.
We are the
umbrella. Of course, yes. Yeah. It's all.
What if we are the umbrella?
Yeah, that's what
it's not separate.
Say, yeah.
No, so, what if we are the umbrella?
Yeah, that's the same thing. Yeah. Same thing, but it's inseparable. We start with understanding inseparability. Because otherwise we might still be localizing something.
So what the author is doing here is we have the universal ground, the five wisdoms. Then to make things complicated, we have the 42 peaceful and the 60 wrathful deities. Don't worry about that unless you really want to get into some cool stuff. And actually, if we talk about the Tibetan Book of the Dead next year, we will talk about the 42 and 58 or 60.
It means blood drinker.
But then, so we have a progression of wisdom. We have a progression of confusion. And that's what follows. And so there are different kinds of ignorance. There's a terrified, blurry cognition. Because we don't recognize the ground. From that, we solidify self and other. That leads to the processes of samsara, that leads to the six realms, which you can look at cosmically or psychologically.
So that's the third and fourth paragraph on page two.
So then he goes into the Hishi. It's a couple. His girlfriend is very important. They go into the different kleshas, and there's a logic to all of them. So it begins with how this problem that we have begins. And the first one is passion or attachment.
Page 3, paragraph 1.
And I'll just start with this one. We'll pay more attention to this. Dualism is doubt. Isn't that interesting? Do you have the same words?
A dualistic mind brings doubt, and subtle clinging is born.
I like dualism is doubt. it's just right there.
Yeah.
Because when we divide the world into self and other, we have to maintain it.
Sure.
And we can't trust anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Then it says, from the emergence of subtle clinging, coarse habit gradually develops. Food, wealth, clothing, places, companions, the five desirables, the sense objects, and beloved relatives, including the people you're married to, beings are tormented by attachment to the pleasant. Okay? That is mundane confusion. Okay? It's ordinary stuff that inhabits our minds. And then he says, oh, so that's the cause, the karmic result. When the fruit of clinging ripens, it says, born as pretas, tormented by craving, how sad is our hunger and thirst. So that would be the full expression of a particular problem that we all have. That, and we know it from our lives, that if we run our lives by some kind of passionate attachment, we tend to fly in all directions, and we wind up feeling insatiably hungry. And the Buddhists have an iconography to, I wouldn't call it an iconography, a way to express, an image to express that. Pretas usually depicted with very thin throats and very big bellies, so they're always hungry, but they can't get food down. So, and we know what that feels like. So that's the karmic consequence. And then is the aspiration. So we're not going to get depressed here. We're going to see the situation for what it is, and we're going to do something about it. May desirous beings, me or you, this is how to do it. Not reject the longing of desire, nor accept the clinging of attachment. Okay? So we develop an equality. A non-accepting, non-rejecting. We let it all in, but at the same time we don't indulge. Then it says, by relaxing cognition as it is, may their awareness take its seat. What do you have for...
allowing the thought to rest in itself. Realize innate rigpa.
Okay. Realize innate rigpa. I like this better. By relaxing... I don't like the word cognition. It sounds too intellectual.
Yeah, I agree. Thought.
But sort of by relaxing the thought as it is, may their awareness take its seat. Okay, so you're with it, you're fully involved, and you're not distracted.
But you're simply because awareness itself has no attachment and has no concern
right.
about making things different. It's simply allowing that resting the nature of your awareness in the experience of your thought.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does, it just basically allows this thought to lighten up mm-hmm. and loosen up and become transparent and disappear fundamentally. And that's when we talk about discriminating wisdom.
So can I say, I think I heard you say this, but I want to check.
Yes.
So the idea of allowing the thought to rest in itself is you have this thought, and you could either say, that's a stupid thought, I'm not going to think that, but that's the best thought I've ever had. And those are not what we want to do.
Correct.
It's just saying, that's just the thought I had.
We're not even saying we're not commenting. We're going beyond. We're learning how to actually stop. Just
rest
from commenting, because that's always putting us in the position of being an observer and an observed. We're simply allowing the insight that is in that momentary flash of just seeing. And that's it.
You know what it's
seeing.
Like? Here's an analogy.
Seeing that there was a thought? Or
seeing, yeah. You're seeing the thought, and you're just letting this, resting in the seeing itself. Now, you can't hang on to that. It's not. You can't say, I'm not going to go from there. You know, it's going to, like, just like
say
the dream, talking about 5 minutes later, what?
No. So, by resting, sometimes they say, rest as if you have finished a day of work. So, it's like, it's not a big, effortful thing. It's like, you've done your stuff. It's like when, I don't know, people like to watch they work at Cumberland Farms from 7 to 3, and they're busy doing this and that. It's like, oh, I'm done, finally. No more stupid people to talk to. And you're watching like your like really terrible afternoon soap opera, because you're home. It's like, oh. You're just sort of watching it. You're not trying to get anything out of it. You're not trying to criticize it. You're just there. And you know what's going on, but it's not a big deal. That's how we rest. We all know this
that's
experience.
That's the nature of General Hospital.
We should go back to actually our meditation instruction. When we talk about shamatha practice...
It's earlier in the afternoon, but that's all right.
And you're actually... You see a thought and you label it, and then the idea is to relax and use your out-breath and experience a little gap. I mean, this is a really very early introduction to the notion of what Joseph's talking about here. Is that gap is actually just there. You know, it's like And it's like, okay, fine, you know, whatever.
And the trick is you can rest in the middle of the agitation, too.
So wondering, Emily, like in my mind, could that, like what they're talking about, that could that be synonymous of like sort of like sky meditating? Like you're just seeing the sky.
You're just letting go into the space.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's like, you're resting because you're not.
I think I'm just seeing.
You're not cranking.
As long as you also appreciate that the moon and the stars and the rain and the clouds are also the sky. It's not just this plain blue sky. There are things happening, but you're resting.
Well, I mean, the sky is right here.
Yeah,
it's right here.
Yep. So we go through all of our ways of being in samsara. So this is like Sumantra Bhar to say, for all those beings who are tormented by competitiveness or pride or aggression, may they not fall for the seduction of their aggressive thoughts, but may they not reject them either. Rest in itself, realize the wisdom that is already there. And then he ends. All beings in the three realms are equal to myself, the Buddha, in the all ground. All beings of the three realms are equal to myself. So this is us, this is our enlightened nature is talking here. It became the ground of mindless confusion. Now they, or we, most of the time, engage in pointless actions. The six actions are like the bewilderment of dreams. Mm-hmm. I am the first Buddha. Actually, you are the first Buddha. And you are the first Buddha.
This is page 4. Paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4.
And Mike is the first Buddha. Muffy is the first Buddha. I tame the six types of beings through emanations. From enlightened mind comes skillfulness that works to wake us up. Through the aspirations of Mantabhadra, may all beings without exception be awakened in the Dharma Dhatu. What do you have?
Almost the same.
Okay. Being things as they are.
May all beings without exception attain enlightenment in Dharma Dhatu.
Yeah.
That's close.
Aho.
Aho.
From now on, whenever a powerful yogin, that's us, within lucid awareness without bewilderness, that's sometimes us, makes this powerful aspiration, all beings who hear it, as part of like you're projecting it to all beings, will be fully awakened within three lives. When the sun or moon is grasped by Rahu, that's an eclipse.
Yeah. Solar or lunar eclipse. Right.
When there's clamor or earthquakes, at the solstices, or at the year's change, now that could be the Jewish year, that could be the Christian year, whatever year you want to do. If you generate some self in Samantabhadra, doesn't mean you have to take off your clothes, but you develop that, you speak from that wisdom that is inherent. Recises the hearing of all. All beings of the three realms will be gradually, unfortunately it's very gradually, free from suffering. Will finally attain Buddhahood through the aspiration of that yoga. So this is an expression of sort of Mahayana generosity toward everyone.
It says also in the notes down below, this is from the Tantra, the Obstructive Clarity of Samantabhadra's Mind, all beings who recite this powerful aspiration will attain enlightenment. So this is somehow a guarantee that we are hastening towards enlightenment in our own experience through this through this recitation.
But still, you have to keep doing it over and over?
Well, I mean, don't kill yourself.
Just
don't
be lifetime.
Careful. Okay. Or who?
Vajrayana is... There's plenty of liturgy and plenty of ritual. And these are all ways in which you sort of become familiar with this material, sort of on a cellular level, on a sort of muscle memory level. And that is one way that we begin to approach this. However, an indispensable way to approach this is through devotion to a teacher. And this kind of universal ground or non-dual primordial mind, it's really helpful to have someone in your life with whom you can identify that, as opposed to, like, you know, the rest of us. And people have their own path, and the teacher in some way will sort of transmit to you that kind of awakeness. And for the rest of your life, you build on it through various and sundry sadistic things that we inflict on people. So. Okay. So what do you think? Any questions? Any thoughts? We're almost running out of time.
Yeah,
a little late.
We are, actually.
Yeah, I could have said a lot more.
I know. This is the whole course, actually. But we touched on a lot of it.
Penetrating Wisdom by Khunlak Rinpoche.
Yeah, excellent.
If you want... Yeah, I'll pass it. Just pass it on. If you want to... I mean, some people will look at this material and just run away. Other people, well, like me a long time ago, was like,
me
oh,
too.
I want this cookie. you know, you may consider diving into it a bit. And this is not too advanced for you. This is you.
I know, when I first heard this and saw this material, I was just blown away by it, and then I found out there was this book, and it was just it just spoke to me. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very profound.
And I figure that I must be getting somewhere along the path, because I get very inspired by this stuff. Mm-hmm. If I didn't get inspired by this stuff, I don't think it would have any meaning for me. So. Who'd like to say something that you haven't said before?
I think it's inspiring too, and thank you for sharing.
You're very welcome. There's a lot of material that's like this that's out there. Didn't used to be.
Well, it's being translated, and fortunately there are people who are actually making it more and more intelligible, mm-hmm, to people here. And a part of it is, it works two ways. We have teachers who come from Tibet and from Tibetan tradition, and then we have practitioners, people who are actually working with the term themselves, mm-hmm, who are Westerners. And that also using it in Western language and understanding and familiarizing this whole process is actually changing the understanding of even what language is and what it does on some level, because these words can carry a lot of blessings.
Yeah.
And we did the Sadha Mahamudra, and some of you have done that before, right?
Yeah.
You know, the idea is that when you recite this, you're simply invoking the blessings of the lineage by reciting this. Anyone can do it. You don't have to have any special permission. But the idea is that you're getting a flavor, some kind of a sense of a direct experience of Vajrayana, of Vajra world.
And one thing that's really helpful that I've found is actually talking about this stuff in a group. Mm-hmm. Because especially when you start reading this stuff, it's sort of subject to the limitations of our own intellect. And other people have different experiences and different approaches. And it really helps us, also helps us to articulate the kinds of things that are sort of there, but sort of not available to us. So, a lot to be said for that. Okay. Close.